Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson. And from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. You might not have heard the name Burke Uzzell. If you did, you'd remember it. But it's likely that you've seen his work. He's been a professional photographer for more than 60 years. His iconic photos include pictures from the memorial for Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the picture that became the album cover for the soundtrack to the movie Woodstock. Now, after decades away, he's back home in North Carolina, embarking on a huge project about race in the South. At 81 years old, he still burns to create. Here's our conversation. The first thing I guess I have to ask about is your name. That's an extraordinary name. I haven't met any other Uzzells in my entire life. Are there a lot of y'all around?
No, not too many. We crawled out from under rocks a long time ago. Only a few of us made it out safely. So, no, there are not many around.
And Burke, where did that come from?
Burke is short for another name. It was a very long and unmentionable name, which I never, ever tell anybody about.
Okay.
But I'm named after my wonderful father.
Now, I understand that as you were growing up, before you sort of were captured by photography, that you thought you might be a musician.
There was a great desire of my mother to make something of me, and I loved music, and she was a sweetheart and would fetch me off to a music lesson once a week down mountain roads and all of that. And I was one of those nerds that practiced a couple of hours after school every afternoon. And I thought I really might want to be a conductor someday.
What all did you play?
Clarinet.
And so what led to the transformation from a clarinetist to a photographer?
Well, I kept seeing Life magazine when I was growing up. And we lived in a little, not too wealthy neighborhood, and we did not even have a television set for most of my youth. And I decided I wanted to travel and see the world and be one of those folks that could do all of those wonderful things.
Where did you grow up, by the way?
Well, I grew up in several towns, born in Raleigh, moved to Canton up in the mountains of North Carolina, to Hickory, and then my dad took a job as city manager in Dunn, North Carolina, down in Harnett County. I knew I wanted to be a photographer, so I didn't have any money, so I had a paper route in the morning, carried the News and Observer every morning at 5:30 in the morning, and so I bought, with the money I made from that, I bought a little box camera, and when something would, a tobacco barn would catch on fire, or there was some siren going down the road, I would take off after it with my bicycle and go take pictures, and I would come home and develop them in my porch dark room and make the prints and send them off to the News and Observer and the other North Carolina newspapers. And often enough, I was lucky enough to see a picture that I would have taken the next morning when I was delivering the newspapers. I would see a picture that I'd taken the day before on the front page of the News and Observer.
What was that like?
It was wonderful because, number one, it excused me from being this kind of short, puny little kid that was too short to play sports or basketball and too dumb to be a writer, I always thought. But I could take pictures and I could follow engines and it got to the point where the revenueers would ask me if I would like to go with them to raid a whiskey still. So I would do that. And then that, of course, was big, wonderful news. It made terrific photographs, and they always got published. They always tried to be very sure that the product they were destroying was a quality project. And, of course, that meant tasting it. So they would taste it and say, well, it's not so bad. Maybe we ought to put a few jugs of this in the trunk of my car. So they would do this, and they would say, now, Now, young Mr. Ussel, wouldn't you like some of this in the trunk of your car? And, of course, I was too young to drink and barely old enough to drive. But we did that. And so my first experience with alcohol was bootleg, and that went on for quite a while.
It sounds like you were doing all this 14, 15, 16 years old, right?
That's correct.
And so what was that like among your peers in high school and all? It seems like you were having a pretty adventuresome life compared to what many of them might have been having.
I was having a great time, but, I was so short when I was in school that when I was in the first grade, my feet wouldn't even reach the floor. But I really loved playing the clarinet. So I was, first chair in the band, and, even in a college band that I played in, I was first chair. But then the excitement of taking photographs, and I really wanted to be a gypsy and see the world. So this duality of lives, and both with their own quality of adventure and achievement, did I think probably did not always play well with some of my peers, but that's okay. I was having a great time.
And how did you make that leap from teenager who wanted to go see the world to photographer who actually got to do it? Were there a couple of key moments in there?
There was a very key moment because when I was a senior in high school, the News and Observer in Raleigh offered me a part-time job if I could get myself up there and I could work the night shift. So I would do that, and I would get myself up there, and I would work the night shift and take pictures, and then I would get myself back to Dunn and go to high school the next morning. And that went on through much of my senior year. And then they said, well, we understand if you want to go to college, but if you don't and you'd be willing to work here for a while, we'd love to have you be a staff photographer at the News and Observer. And, of course, that was very thrilling to me. So that was the beginning of my one and only staff job and regular salary for the whole rest of my life.
And you were, what, 18?
17 or 18, something like that.
And I think part of your bio is that, if I remember right, the youngest staff photographer ever at Life magazine when you were 23. Have I got that right? So what happened in those 5 years, 6 years to get you there?
Well, I had met this wonderful lady who was also working at the News and Observer in the library. And we started going out, and pretty soon we got married at the age of 18, or I guess we got married at maybe 19. And then when she was 7 months pregnant, we decided, well, since I have $200 and I had myself two Leicas that I had bought, this would be a terrific time to become a freelance photographer. So always with a great mind for business, I quit my job. And we moved to Atlanta, and a very good photographer there let me come on as his assistant. And so I worked there, and she came down. And one of my first experiences with him was to go photograph the birth of a baby. And she was about to have one herself, so that was a great joy ride for both of us to see. Ah, so this is how all this happens. But my actual first assignment in Atlanta, first real magazine assignment, was from Jet Magazine, and they called up and wanted my employer to go do a portrait of young fellow by the name of Martin Luther King Jr., sitting on his couch in his little home in Atlanta. So he was not available, so they let me go do it. And Jet Magazine ran the picture, and they were happy with me and continued to give me assignments.
And when did you first realize that this fellow you had photographed years before was becoming this person who was making a big impact on the country?
Well, it wasn't long after that. You know, I spent this year in Houston, and then Life offered me a contract to move away and move to Chicago. And no sooner than I did that than, of course, I was, I was quickly into that terrible decade when there was a lot of civil rights demonstrating. And of course, I was often about photographing all of that. And, you know, Dr. King was, of course, always in the middle of these things as well. So I had some not so happy adventures in trying to photograph some of these civil rights experiences. And then, I was not ever at Dr. King's elbow through any of that, but of course, reading about him and seeing him on TV all of this time.
I wanted to go back. You said, sort of in passing, you had some not so happy experiences. What are some things that happened back then?
Well, I remember I was on a life assignment in I think it was Cicero, and that we were. I was walking with the blacks, down the street, and people, the white people up on the top of 2-3 story buildings, were throwing bricks off the top of the building, trying to hit people on the head. So that was not what I would call Southern hospitality.
No.
So that made me very uncomfortable. But then, you know, then you'd get kind of typically roughed up a bit in these crowds and things. And so people like to push photographers around a lot. And I was an easy target since I was this kind of puny little guy. And so that would happen.
I've heard you tell the story about when and how you found out that Dr. King had been assassinated, and it involved right as you got off a plane, right?
Oh, my goodness. That's it's hard for me to even think of that moment without crying. But I was on an airplane. By then, Cardi and the boys and myself had moved to the Washington Bureau of Life magazine, and I was getting off the airplane there at Washington National Airport, and my wife met me at the gate, and she handed me a bag of film and an airplane ticket and says, "Dr. King has just been killed in Memphis, Tennessee, and I knew you would want to be there. So the next plane from Memphis leaves in 20 minutes, and it's just down, just a few gates down." And she gave me a hug and a kiss and sent me off to Memphis, and away I went.
So when you're in that moment where it's obviously a very tragic moment, a very intimate moment, and you're in there as a photographer and you have gear and you have a machine that makes noise and you're trying to get in the best place for the best shot, how do you kind of strike that balance in your head between what the moment needs, what the people there desire, all of those things?
It's very hard not to be in the moment. Because it's obviously a terribly emotional thing to be witnessing, but there's something about being behind a camera that allows me to function. And you know, there are some cameras that are noisier than others. And happily, I was using the really quiet Leica camera in those days, and that got me through those difficulties. I try to be very sensitive to the people around me, and it's not always easy because emotion is what drives, I think, any great artist, and particularly a photographer in an event like that.
When we come back, Burke also talks about showing up at Woodstock with no assignment and coming out with his most famous photo. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all. If you like Southbound, let me tell you about another one of my favorite podcasts about the South, the Bitter Southerner Podcast. It's hosted by my buddy Chuck Reese, who is a guest himself here on Southbound a while ago. Chuck runs a digital magazine out of Atlanta that's also called The Bitter Southerner, which features some of the region's finest writing. On his podcast with Georgia Public Broadcasting, Chuck explores things like the mysteries of the Southern accent and how the Music Maker Relief Foundation is keeping the blues alive. His work is sunk deep in the Southern soil. So go ahead, give a listen to The Bitter Southerner podcast on NPR One or wherever else you get podcasts. Now, let's get back to Southbound and our conversation with Burke Ozzel. You shot the photo that became the sort of iconic album cover of Woodstock and that sort of thing. I guess, you know, I've heard many stories over the years about people who showed up at Woodstock. They had no idea it was going to be that big a deal or anything like that. What was your kind of understanding going in as to what it would be like?
I was, at that moment, a member photographer of an outfit called Magnum Photos. And the director of Magnum had a farm with some really nice acreage up near Woodstock. And we decided, Cardi and the Tad and Andy, my sons, decided we would go camping and up on a trout stream and have a nice time. And we pitched our tents and said, you know, there's a music festival down the road. Why don't we just drive down to the music festival and just hear some tunes, and then we'll come back tonight. And so I did. So we packed up, and, you know, being a father of young sons, I always carry a knapsack with some animal crackers and canned fruit and a poncho in case it rains. And I just stuffed a few rolls of black and white film in my pocket, and I had my two Leicas, and off we went. We got into Woodstock coming from a direction other than New York City, coming from upstate New York. We got in pretty easily. But then once we were in, it wasn't long after that, they just closed the interstate down, and we knew that we were there to stay. There was no getting out, so we figured out a way to make our own selves a little camp spot, and we stayed there.
So I want to make sure I get this clear. First of all, this wasn't really an assignment for you. You just kind of went down to see what it was like.
Yes. No, that's a very interesting point you make, and it's something I've always been very careful about. And I think it's important for a photographer that attends events like that he thinks might be significant of interest, like the Martin Luther King funeral or Woodstock or many other things that I photographed. I'd always decline assignments. I could have certainly had my choice of most any magazine assignment I wanted for either one of those events, but I choose to go on my own. And that's because I've discovered that editors sitting in New York do feel that they know everything about everything there is to know, and that I really have no interest in having them tell me, okay, be sure to do this and do that. And I'm particularly at Woodstock, so I declined an assignment, and in fact, that's why exactly I did good work, because I started wandering around and left the music stage, and it wasn't long before I was up on the top of the hill and where I saw the people undressing and going skinny dipping in the ponds up there, which is a terrific thing to see, particularly in those days. And, you know, all those years ago, people looked really, really good. We did not have the run on obesity that we now have in contemporary world. So here are all these people with nothing on, skinny dipping. And so I started gleefully taking photographs, but one frame at a time, because I knew I had only a little film, and I was worried to death I would run out. So I was being extremely careful about choosing the right moment to take the picture. So I saw I was getting low on film, and I had no color film whatsoever. So I went down to the stage, and I knew all the photographers down there. And I said, hey, guys, let me tell you what's going on up there on the hillside. And I would tell them, these people have no clothes on, and they're running and jumping in the water, and it's a beautiful thing to see. You wouldn't really enjoy seeing that. And they said, but, you know, my editor wants me to be sure to get Ravi Shankar, and my editor wants me to get Jimi Hendrix, and we're not permitted to leave the stage. And I said, okay, since you can't leave the stage, could you loan me a few rolls of color film? So they did, and Charles Harbutt, a friend, another member of Magnum Photos, as myself, loaned me some color film, and the cover photograph of the Woodstock album was taken on borrowed color film from Charles Harbutt.
I went and looked at, did a little bit of research on this, and it turns out the couple in that photo at least to the last story I saw from a couple of years ago, are still together.
They are still together, and it was for the 40th anniversary of Woodstock. Smithsonian Magazine asked if I would go up and meet them for the first time and take their portrait, and I did. And they were wonderful, and we took a nice picture and had a nice time, and I came back and they ran the picture.
Now, I know those are kind of the famous things that you've shot over the years, that when people look at your portfolio, those might be the first things they think of. I wonder if there are a couple of stories you've done or photos you've made or things that might be lesser known that really strike your memory.
On my own nickel, I would frequently travel, particularly on small back roads, all through the South, and I would go down into Mississippi. And I've always been very concerned about the lives of black folks in the South. And I would make it a point to hang out with people that were picking cotton or had really not much money at all. And part of that came from another life assignment, which was to go down and do a story on a man called Lish, who lived along not far from the Mississippi River, but down in the South. And those people, they would get stale bread from the local bakeries, and the only thing they could put on those stale pieces of bread was lard. And they would have large sandwiches to eat. And Lish could not read or write, but his daughter was teaching him to read and write, who was, of course, going to school. And those touching photographs, I will never, ever forget being in their company and the humor they had, the humanity they had, loving, incredibly loving, beautiful people. And I have always cared very much about trying to tell the real story of how black folks live in the South, both now and then. And I have a huge, big project going on now, which I'm just starting in my studio, all about this very stuff.
Now, is that why you came back to North Carolina?
I'd lived in Florida for a while. I lived in Philadelphia for a while. I left Philadelphia and moved to Seattle, lived 1 year there, couldn't stand the weather and the rain. And the director of a museum in Chapel Hill, Emily Cass, and her husband, Chuck Weinrob, said, you know, you can come back to North Carolina now. It's not as bad as it used to be. It's much more liberal and it's not all that bad. So I came down and I stayed with them for a while and looked around all over North Carolina for a suitable place to live. Asheville was too cold. I didn't want my file washed away if I'd moved to Wilmington. So I picked a little town called Wilson, North Carolina, a mid-sized town. And I loved Wilson because it was beautiful and it was full of middle-class people, and a lot of them were black. And I knew that this was to be my home because these would be my future subjects. And that has come true. And I've made great friends there, and I have an incredible 18,000-square-foot studio done from two adjoining buildings in downtown Wilson.
So what in particular are you aiming, this project you're working on, what's the goal?
The goal is to tell the truth about the amazing progress that black people have made since the days of lynching. I'm bringing them into my studio in a project called Prophets. So these prophets are the people that can forecast the future. It's not meant to be taken in the religious context, but I take it as an indication that these are forward-thinking people, and they are at one and the same time leaders as well as survivors. So I've had a wonderful set built in my studio, and I have lynching ropes hanging from the ceiling.
Wow. I imagine a lot of the people that you approach as potential photo subjects have dealt with a lot of older white guys in their lives who have not treated them well. How do you earn their trust?
I had to attend to some of the white racism that I had grown up with. And I'm still, to this day, I see no small amount of white racism, and often from very wealthy people. So I decided to invite the man who works on my building to come over, and we created this set, and we hung all these ropes from the ceiling. And I show my potential subjects these photographs and tell them what I'm up to and what Prophets is all about. And they then are made welcome, and they come, and they show up there, and they're not afraid. They're certainly not afraid of me. And they're very happy to tell their stories.
That's interesting, because I would think, as well-meaning as you might be, somebody walks into that studio and they see lynching ropes hanging there and that sort of thing. I'm surprised you haven't gotten stronger negative reactions from folks.
Well, I tell them what they're going to see before they walk in.
Right.
And I've been very concerned about this whole business of social issues for some time. And one of the photographs that I took, which you see on my website, called Targets, which is of some young children, very young children, 7, 8, 9 years old, which I borrowed from a black school in Wilson, North Carolina. They loaned me a dozen or so kids, multiracial, multigender, on the condition that they could send over their entire art department, which they did. And the parents of all the children came along. And I gathered them together in the gallery part of my building. And I said, now look, we're going to go in, and you're going to see a rifle, an AR-17, which is the weapon of choice for killing school kids. But we've taken the firing mechanism out of it, and we want you to know that it couldn't possibly hurt you. So, and this picture is to illustrate the tragedy of all of this happening.
I wonder how much of that was in your head or in your heart back when you were 14 years old and starting to do all this. Was there a moment at which it became more than just sort of a job to you, but a calling or this artistic moment for you? When did that happen?
It was because of my relationship to music. Musicians make very good photographers, and there is, in fact, a tradition of that happening. Jethro Waters, the filmmaker that has worked with me, is an incredible rock and roll musician and has earned a living of that. Many fine photographers were musicians first. Music is sensual. Music is about the heart and sensuality. Photography, when it's good, is music. So all I learned as a musician, playing scales, but then feeling free to improvise and to try to do jazz or to do modern music or listening to modern music, it all comes from the relationship in my heart from music to photography. They became one and the same.
As somebody who has been doing what you love to do for a long time, I know there are a lot of young artists just starting out who may not know if they're going to get to do this for very long. What have been the things that have kept you surviving and thriving as a photographer for as long as you've been able to do it?
Well, no small part of it, and that is a really smart question, because remember, I grew up at a time when I was developing pictures and in a dark room, and a very makeshift dark room at that. And then I'm old enough to have watched the medium grow up. You know, now we're doing amazing digital files with stuff that nobody could have ever even dreamed of having, making prints the size of a wall. You know, that's astonishing. We couldn't do that when I was a young photographer. So I have watched the medium mature and grow up, and you know, we have new tools to work with all the time. And just keeping up with the medium, just following it, you know, and learning how to use the new stuff keeps you sharp. You've got a hump to do that stuff. You got to know what you're doing to be able to compete in this very competitive world. And that implies knowing the gear, knowing it well, and knowing your craft, and studying, by the way, aesthetics. You've got to do your homework in a museum. Your eye is not born smart. Your eye is born from looking at the work of sculptors and painters. So you've got to be doing all of this simultaneously. You've got to be evolving your eye through looking at great art. At the same time, you're evolving your sense of craft to just keep up with the medium. I'm very happy that when I went to work for Life magazine, very young, they sent me to the Chicago Bureau. And any free moment I had, I was at the Art Institute of Chicago looking at painting, none of which I understood. I couldn't make heads or tails. Why would anybody look at a Rothko? Why would anybody want to do something with all those dots on them? Why would anybody want to do all the stuff I was seeing? And you know what? I looked and I learned and I just made myself dig in. And one of the proudest things that ever happened into my life was my first solo exhibition in my life was at the Art Institute of Chicago in 1971.
Burke Uzzell has spent his whole life betting on himself. He hustled after stories from the time he was a teenager. He lived in tiny apartments so he could pay the bills with his work. He wandered into events without assignments so he could follow his instincts. It's a risky way to live. If you don't get the goods, you don't get paid. And he benefited from living in an era when white men took up almost all the places at the front of the line. But even now, when most of us would be propping up our feet, he's still working. Part of that might be his particular compulsion. But part of it, I think, comes from the value of work itself. All those years of learning his craft are like planting an orchard. If you do it right and keep it tended, it can bear fruit as long as you live. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our audio engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guests. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.